Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your host from SteelersDepot.com, where you can find all your latest and greatest Steelers news. It's Dave Bryan and Alex Cazzora, always Lynn, talking Steelers. And now, here's Dave and Alex.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast, Season 14, Episode 83. He's Dave Bryan. I'm Alex Cazzora, SteelersDepot.com. Thanks for being back with us here this Monday, Steelers Nation. The championship games wrapping up on Sunday. We now know the two teams will play in the Super Bowl in Las Vegas, February 11th. That will be the Kansas City Chiefs against the San Francisco 49ers. Exciting day of playoff action. And despite the Steelers, of course, not playing this weekend, still plenty of Steelers-related news to talk about. New players, new coaches, and the candidate search for the offensive coordinator in Pittsburgh. Dave, how you doing? How was your weekend?
Went fairly quick. It was entertaining with a couple of those games, two different kind of games, the way those things played out. I'm sure we'll have a little bit to talk about when it comes to some decisions made in a couple of those games. Obviously got some coordinator search news to pass along and discuss. And where would you like to begin?
Well, let's start right there. Let's start with an update to the Pittsburgh Steelers coordinator search. One name is out of the running, and one name was added over the weekend. Zach Robinson, who never actually had an official or really any sort of interview to our knowledge with Pittsburgh, is now the Atlanta Falcons offensive coordinator. No surprise there. Once Raheem Morris, the Rams DC, was hired by Atlanta as their head coach late last week, we had the assumption and the reporting was indicating that Robinson, the Rams pass game coordinator, would follow him to Atlanta and become the OC. So he is out. That left, in terms of known interview candidates, Thomas Brown, Gerard Johnson. But on Sunday, you can add one Arthur Smith to that list, the former Falcons head coach, fired after three seasons following the 2023 season. Former Tennessee Titans offensive coordinator had success there. So his name is now in the fold. Official interview on Sunday before Pittsburgh departed for Mobile, Alabama in the 2024 Senior Bowl. And Dave, just kind of gut instinct right now that they might talk to others. Smith might be the guy.
Oh, boy. And Steeler fans are excited about that on this Monday, aren't they?
Catch the fever.
Arthur Smith. Boy. They seemed excited. And I imagine a lot of merchandise was sold yesterday. And the optimism level through the roof and all like that. No, that predictably went over like a lead balloon, I think, overall. But you've got a probably an article that people won't like to read, but probably need to read. And, you know, immediately after that, that news broke yesterday morning, I was able to pull some stats, from Sports Info Solutions up, and we already kind of knew a loose kind of, background on them, overall, but I would venture a guess that in the last, 16 hours or so, that, you know, we, you and I both have learned a little bit more about him. And, you know, I think that you kind of alluded to, man, you kind of wonder if this is the way this thing might end up going with Arthur Smith, right?
Right. And frankly, I probably should have had more foresight to this. I mentioned his name in an article I wrote a couple days ago, kind of just recapping where Pittsburgh was at and the kind of state of the Steelers coordinator search as a potential name that fits. And he's not the hire as of right now, as of Monday at 10:30 a.m. Eastern time. So we'll see. Could they talk to others? That's possible. It's, you know, wouldn't surprise anybody if they did. But in terms of kind of a broader base, what they're looking for, somebody that has experience, you know, has worked with quarterbacks. Smith does not have a real true background with quarterbacks, but he's been an OC, he's been a head coach. And so those things all are kind of part and parcel. He fits that better than Thomas Brown, better than a Gerard Johnson. And I believe Pittsburgh's the only team that's interviewed Smith so far. So bottom line is, you know, if he does become the hire, there's kind of an alignment of visions in terms of Smith's background, what Pittsburgh's offense is built to do. They would make this a logical, though probably not super inspiring, fit.
I guess the only other, I mean, look, I mean, we haven't heard anything about Bevel, right? Up until this point. And obviously the team's only officially announced, the interviewing of three people, in total. I guess, you know, with the 49ers in the Super Bowl, there's still, we could still hold out a little bit of hope that maybe he's a candidate still to be talked to on the list.
You're talking about Clint Kubiak.
Yeah, Kubiak. Okay. What did I say?
Well, you said Bevel, which is, we hadn't heard anything on that. You just said, I thought you just left out his name.
Oh, okay. Kubiak, yeah. With that's what I was going with, 49ers and all. Okay. There. So, but, you know, still we haven't heard, you know, other than you know, outside of us, you mm-hmm. know, speculating that he might be on the list. We haven't heard about that. And obviously with the, I think, what are the rules with that? If they had held a Zoom meeting prior to this, then they could have talked to him. What are the rules on that?
I think that's right. I know for coaches, if you held a virtual interview prior to, I think, the divisional round, then you could have an in-person interview at some point after. I'm a little shaky on the rules, especially for coordinators. I don't know if it's exactly the same, and they changed things recently, so I don't want to speak incorrectly there. But either way, you know, given the Pittsburgh's at the Senior Bowl, and it feels like they like doing these in-person interviews. I don't know for sure if these have happened, but I don't know. It just kind of feels like these are in-person type meetings as opposed to virtual. I could be wrong about that. But if that is the case, then with Pittsburgh at the Senior Bowl and Kubiak not there, obviously getting ready for the Super Bowl, I'm not sure when they would get the chance to speak until after the Super Bowl.
Well, let's put it this way. If we get, you know, we would probably have to get through this week, especially with the Senior Bowl getting underway. If no decision, no new OC is named, then maybe we can hold out hope that Kubiak will be still on the list to interview.
Right. But Arthur Smith, last three seasons in Atlanta have not gone well. They are in 26th in scoring offense twice, including this past season, 15th in the other year. That was in 2022. But it's a run heavy approach. He wants big personnel. No team used big personnel as often as Atlanta did last year, despite them playing from behind and, you know, having a losing record, collapsing down the stretch. Again, had success in Tennessee, you know, downhill run game, obviously had Derrick Henry. Pittsburgh doesn't have a player like Derrick Henry, but they have a bruiser, a downhill big guy in Najee Harris. You can see the similarities there. So just from a standpoint of experience, of philosophy, there's a fit there. The question is it kind of more of the same? Are you getting any additional wrinkle to it? But I'd have to do a little bit more research on Smith's background, his philosophy, but just kind of the broader base things, the style, the numbers that we pulled, you know, what he runs is what Pittsburgh was the last month of the season.
I tell you what is not encouraging is when you look up his past run tendencies, not only in Atlanta last year, but the couple of years in Tennessee as well, too. Predominantly been a zone heavy team. In fact, according to Sports Info Solutions, last season was the number one ranked zone run percentage offense and 32nd overall in gap run percentages. And as we saw with the Steelers last year, opened up heavy with the zone run schemes and not great success there at all, and really didn't start finding their footing until they started running more gap stuff, what, week 7, 8, 9, somewhere mm-hmm. around in there. And when you go back to what were the years in Tennessee, 19 to 21 or something like that?
19 and 20.
I think third overall and second overall, respectively, as far as where those two offenses in those 2 years with the Titans ranked as far as zone run percentage. Now, does that mean that he comes in and says, we got to run zone for this to work? You know, I don't know. And obviously, it's yet to be seen if, you know, who the offensive line coach might end up being, if he'll insist on going. You know, there was obviously the name of Mike Munchak attached to him in this, you know, rumor floating around last week. We'll have to see how that goes and all like that. But I mean, on the surface, it feels like he's going to come. He would come in with the idea that he would like to run a lot of zone.
Right, which is not Pittsburgh's, you know, bread and butter. They're a varied rushing attack. They can and they do run some inside zone, but they really found their success and hit their stride once they incorporated their you know, gap scheme, power scheme, these wham blocks, double wham crunch, whatever you want to call it. They were a zone exclusive team the first month of the year. They didn't pull their guards on a run play once the first four games. And we were critical of that, and their run game struggled mightily. They were just a really bad zone blocking team. They became much more effective when they were more varied, and they got the ball on the outside in some respect. They ran their toss game quite a bit, but it was still power, more downhill based. So that's all, you know, maybe cart before the horse in terms of getting into those details, but it's a fair point. And you do wonder if he is to hire, will Pittsburgh get away from what worked, you know, so effectively the last half of 2023?
Looking at just the Falcons from last season from a play action standpoint, usage percentage ranked, I think, 13th overall, so right around in the middle of the league. Pass off of play action was, believe it or not, I think second highest in the NFL as far as usage rank, whereas run was down low there, but at least there's a little bit of play action. Seems to be, at least I didn't look back at 19 and 20 there. Doesn't seem to use a lot of RPOs overall. Shotgun percentage looks like it was 77% usage last season with Atlanta, which ranked 12th overall. Run out of shotgun was I think 37%, and pass out of shotgun 63% there. So, I mean, the thing that really jumps, without obviously going deep into the tape, which, you know, neither of us have done yet, because obviously we won't do that probably, and or we won't do that until we know whether or not he's going to be the guy. The thing that really jumps out overall is just that, you know, he seems to be a zone run guy.
And heavy personnel guy. I mean, you pulled up the numbers in terms of what they ran in their big people packages. They were first in the NFL last year in 12 personnel. That's two tight end sets. They were second in the NFL in 22 personnel, two backs, two tight ends. They were third in the NFL in 13 personnel, three tight ends. They were fifth in the NFL in 21 personnel. That's two running backs. They were last in the NFL in 11 personnel. That's three receiver sets, kind of base offense, which is how most teams, including Pittsburgh, will operate from the majority of the time. And they were 7-10. And so they were playing from behind, and they're still 32nd in that 11 personnel, kind of just your base passing grouping personnel. So it just kind of speaks to the mindset. What I think of when I think of Arthur Smith last year was the criticism of not getting the ball to their playmakers consistently enough. Kyle Pitts has been, I think, underutilized the last 2 years, especially
way underutilized.
A bit more action in 23, but still probably they had Drake London, and that was really it. They had a receiver, and they still could not get Pitts the ball as much as he should. And then Bijan Robinson, they take him, what, seventh overall, their stud running back. He averaged 12 and a half carries per game, and his usage kind of waxed and waned. And so you wonder, in Pittsburgh, they get the same critiques where you're getting Freiermuth the ball enough and Warren the ball enough and Pickens the ball enough. And if you do hire Arthur Smith, you have a coach that took a lot of heat for maybe not utilizing his playmakers as much as people thought he should.
Yeah, and obviously they had, you know, a revolving door at quarterback last season, and on the surface, going to be challenged at the quarterback position, at least where we sit right now, when it comes to the 2024 Steelers, or at least a lot of questions about it, right?
Right. In a lot of ways, Atlanta's offense and Pittsburgh's offense was pretty similar last season.
All right, so people probably not hearing a lot of excitement in our voice, right? We're not the parade organizers.
Well, I mean, the upshot of Smith and why he became a head coach in the first place was those Tennessee Titans offenses, 19 and 20, were really good. I mean, they were top 10 both years. Derrick Henry, 2,000-yard season. Ryan Tannehill in 2020 threw 33 touchdown passes. People probably forget that kind of stat. So they put up numbers. They put up points and they put up yards and they ran the ball a lot. So that's a track record of success. And, you know, we see sometimes these head coaches get elevated into larger roles and they're not probably meant to be head coaches. And he could still be potentially a really strong coordinator because he does have that background there. So I do want to talk about the good things. And again, visions aligning in terms of what his style is, what Pittsburgh's style appears to be, what they want to be. I get the fit, but, you know, wouldn't be the most exciting hire, and you do kind of wonder, okay, how can he elevate this offense to a next? Can this offense take a leap, or will it just take maybe a step if Arthur Smith is running the show?
Well, and I think the key thing to highlight there is when he did have the success in Tennessee, at least he had an experienced quarterback, a pedigree quarterback in Ryan Tannehill.
Sure, he did. Did he kind of, was Tannehill having success before Smith became the OC? Because obviously it didn't work out in Miami. When did Tannehill get to Tennessee? I want to get the timeline correct. He got there in 2019, actually, which is when Smith's first year as the OC. So, I mean, Tannehill really turned his career around under Arthur Smith.
Right. Did you get any? And obviously Ryan Tannehill's probably going to be out in Tennessee now, right?
Yeah, I would assume so. Will Levis is going to be the guy.
And you would think that the market's not going to be hugely ripe for Tannehill, right?
No, there shouldn't be much of a – he's going to be 36. I mean, in terms of him coming to Pittsburgh potentially, you know, I know there was success there, but at this stage in his career, 2019 feels like, you know, eternity ago. So right. I wouldn't assume that's going to be the case.
Well, what I'm getting at there is you know, if they're unable to get a guy like Mason Rudolph back under contract, could they go the direction of a Tannehill?
Yeah, I mean, that if Rudolph doesn't return, the door kind of becomes wide open for veteran options. But man, can you do a bit better than a 36-year-old, you know, injured quite a bit, regressing Ryan Tannehill? I hope you could if you really want to, you know, push Kenny Pickett. But I mean, it's a valid point by you.
You threw out the Mike Mularkey reference.
Yeah, and you tell me, you probably remember the Mularkey era a bit better and clearer than I do, but I just kind of had the vision of, you know, run first, run-oriented coach, and same path. They're both tight end coaches at one point in their career. Maybe Mularkey, you know, Mularkey had some more trick plays potentially than Arthur Smith's. Maybe that's one difference I'd have, and I got to do more research probably on Arthur Smith's background, but did that strike you as kind of like, yeah, you know, we get that run-oriented, run-heavy type of coach. That's kind of always been his background. That was just kind of the feel I got initially when I saw the interview request come in.
I obviously haven't gone deep down into the rabbit hole of going back and researching Mularkey offenses, but obviously in the time that he was in Pittsburgh, I mean, that kind of play, that kind of ball offense was in vogue, right?
Right. Yeah, it was a different era, obviously. And so when I say Mularkey, it's in some, you know, potential respects, a compliment, because Mularkey had a couple good years of solid offenses in Pittsburgh, but also, you know, a bad year in 2003. And you wonder if that kind of philosophy can work in this modern, you know, going into 2024.
I looked at the bio more in depth on Arthur Smith as well, too. And I, you know, there's no, you know, no evident links. You know, normally you can connect some dots here and connect the dots here, but other than kind of style of offense, I guess there's nothing that links him to Mike Tomlin, you know, or the Steelers, it doesn't seem like.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any sort of actual connection. I think Arthur Smith is best known for being the son of the founder of FedEx, is the kind of the story with him.
Yeah. All right. Well, I mean, when you roll back to what Mike Tomlin had to say in the year-end press conference, and, you know, having the experience as a play caller and, you know, working some with quarterbacks, I guess. I mean, of all the three that they've talked to, and we're not talking about an expansive list right now, Arthur Smith checks the most boxes.
He does. And I would say he's the, for whatever it's worth, and we're all kind of just guessing here. And again, they may talk to others, but the front runner, it would feel like. I mean, I feel like they would be interested in Gerard Johnson, but he's a hot name that's got a lot of interest, and we'll see what happens there. And Thomas Brown, you know, I've heard he's interviewed well. He's actually in the mix in Tennessee right now, I think, for the OC job. But, you know, the resume is not, it's not as good as Arthur Smith's.
Well, that, you know, the other two don't really match up what at least Mike Tomlin had laid out there.
Yeah, in terms of the experience. Well, I mean, right. But I mean, you know, Tomlin also mentioned the quarterback background, and that's not exactly Smith's background. Right. Gerard Johnson was coaching C.J. Stroud and a quarterback. I mean, again, Smith has worked with quarterbacks. He's been an OC, been a head coach. That's part of the job, but doesn't have that quite as tried and true. Just three other things on Arthur Smith. And I know we're kind of talking about him maybe incorrectly as like he's already been the hire, and he's right. Not, and maybe they don't hire the guy at all. This is all just wasted breath and energy, but it's a Monday, and you know, we'll see. Just kind of feels like it's going to go that way right now. But only 41, he's still a young guy. You know, we're talking about young hires, and you want coaches that are young, not the old guys. Dude's 41. It's the mustache that makes him look like he's, you know, 51 or something. And also, if you want a Steelers connection, teammates with Willie Parker at North Carolina.
Oh.
So there is your deep nugget on the
there
connection.
There you go.
Yeah, neither a guy played that much at North Carolina. Smith was a guard. Parker, of course, a running back. But that is a very mild and meaningless Steelers connection.
Okay. All right. One person has been linked to the Steelers that won't be the offensive coordinator is Zach Robinson.
Right, going to Atlanta as the OC. Funny how these things all work out. Smith is out in Atlanta. Raheem Morris comes in, takes Robinson with him. Pittsburgh, don't think they ever talked to Zach Robinson, who was in demand this cycle. So might have been their choice, but no longer their choice.
All right. So who else out there that was on your list, your initial list of what was it, five or six? I mean, Bevel was on that list.
Mm-hmm.
Who else was on that list? Kubiak was on that list.
Yeah, Kubiak, Alex Van Pelt. We've heard nothing on him. He's got some interviews around the league. I think at the Raiders in Tampa Bay, I believe. Liam Cohen, who's the Kentucky OC. Haven't heard much on him. Bevel, I don't believe, has gotten any interest this cycle, which surprised me. Thought he would at least get maybe a look somewhere, considering the success in Miami. And I don't know who else was on that. Shane Waldron, but of course he was already hired by the time that article actually ran. So it does not appear that they're interested in those things. Maybe Kubiak. I mean, I hope they at least talk to Kubiak. How do you not talk to the guy? You know, people say Brian Griese. I don't think Griese is going to be the candidate. He's just so – he just started coaching. You can't make him an OC based off of like a year and a half or 2 years of coaching. But at least talk to Kubiak. What would be the downside to have a conversation with the guy? It feels like that's where it could match some of your ideals in terms of your bread and butter kind of run game, but marry that with a good pass game and have some layers and some excitement to it. That's kind of what you're looking for. You want to still be a run-oriented team, but have some layers and some really creative looks to build off of that. Kubiak, I think, would potentially offer that, so at least talk to the guy, see. I mean, he's gotten some interest, but it's not like he's been interviewed by 10 teams. I think he has two interviews so far, so at least have a conversation.
Okay, so that's that should bring everybody up to date. No white smoke coming out of the South Side yet, right?
Not yet, but that's at some point. I mean, they're probably leaving or in Mobile right now. I don't think a hire would come during this week when they're busy, you know, scouting, evaluating, meeting with players. So maybe when they come back again, I've always kind of tabbed first week of February or later in that kind of first week of February is the date that I think something will come across, but we'll see.
All right. We shall see. Anything else to add as far as coordinator and coaches? Sounds like some Raven coaches are going to get some interviews across the league, right?
Yeah, Mike McDonald, and I think that's out in Seattle, and he might be their guy because Seattle's been waiting. Maybe they've been waiting for a Mike McDonald, and then Anthony Weaver, the D-line coach and assistant head coach in Baltimore, getting some looks in Washington. We still think it's going to be Ben Johnson, the Lions OC, to become the Commander's new head coach, but Anthony Weaver, got to mention his name, and the Ravens could have a playoff loss and a loss of coaches as well.
All right.
Should note, I don't think the Raiders nor Saints have filled their OC spots, and Mike Sullivan had the interviews there, so we're still kind of waiting to see what happens with both those names. I wonder if they were to hire an Arthur Smith, would they, you know, if Sullivan left, would they go try to find just the best quarterback coach they could just to try to fill that, or do you keep Sullivan and try to have a bridge between new and old so it's not all brand new for a Kenny Pickett?
Who was the quarterback's coach in Tennessee
then? During Smith's time there?
Right.
It's a good question. I can try to pull it up. I do not know top of my head. Pat O'Hara in 2019. I mean, I'm not super familiar with. He is still with the Titans, it looks like. I'm not sure if he's surviving the head coaching change, though.
And who was the Falcons quarterback's coach last year?
I know the OC was Dave Ragone, and I don't know what his status is with Morris. I don't know who the quarterback coach was in 2022. Charles London. What's going on with Charles London? He's still in Atlanta. He is in Tennessee as well, actually. He's the quarterback's coach for the Titans. But again, I'm not 100% sure if he is surviving
the
new staff with Brian Catlin, which, I mean, could increase the odds as one of those guys making their way to Pittsburgh.
All right.
All right. So good point there. But again, we'll just wait and see. I know I'm kind of talking as if Smith has already been hired, and he's not. So just kind of maybe I'll pump my own brakes on that. Dave, some other Steelers news. Kind of a weird one as well. A soon-to-be Steeler, but I guess technically not a Steeler yet. Jeremiah Moon, the former, maybe current, I guess, I don't know how to define this, linebacker of the Ravens, was waived to make room for Mark Andrews. Pittsburgh claimed him off of waivers, but a quirk of this time of year, that move could not become official until the day after the Super Bowl. So February 12th, that waiver claim can officially be processed and Moon can become a Steeler. So he's in this purgatory, but give it 2 weeks and he'll be a Steeler.
You know, just as much as you think that you, as much as someone like me tries to stay on top of the CBA and things that happen and different kind of off the cuff kind of transactions, you think that you've are on top of everything and seen everything before, and then something else happens and you're like, wow, I'm not sure I've seen that before. And on the surface, and I use that carefully, this looks like a pretty shrewd move on the part of the Steelers. And I can't for the life of me remember after, you know, in a period of time, you know, after a season ends, especially when you got one team still in the playoffs at the time, you know, heading into this week this past week with the Ravens, of a team waiving a guy, another team claiming him that's already out of the playoff picture, and then having, you know, as you indicated there, I think that move was listed on the NFL transaction sheet as needing to be deferred until the Monday, the first business day after the Super Bowl there. Now, why do I call it kind of a shrewd move? Well, first and foremost, you would think that and the Ravens waived him, I think, to make room for Mark Andrews to have that roster spot there. And Moon has spent quite a bit of time, I think, on the Ravens roster, especially, I think, in the second half of the season there. He didn't spend the whole season on there, I don't think, did he?
He bounced between practice squad and 53-man roster.
Okay, yeah. Okay. So you would think that the idea for the Ravens would have been to waive him, and then obviously they were hoping to win the game, yada, yada, and then probably get him back to the practice squad there, and had indeed their season ended, or like it did on Sunday there, that they would have turned around and try to sign him to a reserve future contract there. Well, by claiming him off waivers, the player has no choice at that point. And the other interesting thing about it is, unless I'm missing something here, had he ended the season on the Ravens regular 53-man roster, he would have been scheduled to become an exclusive rights free agent. Well, by claiming him in the manner that they did, it should still stick that he's still scheduled to become an exclusive rights free agent. The only difference now is that the Steelers would control that moving forward. And what does that mean? Well, exclusive rights free agents are easily retained because all you have to do is offer them a minimum salary contract here. So it's shrewd in the fact that if everything holds as it appears like it is, at least on paper, that this, he will become a Steeler on Monday, February the 12th. Now, here's the other interesting aspect of it, because this is not a typical, you know, or it isn't at least on the surface to be, you know, a reserve future signing, which means that those contracts go into effect the first day of the new league year here. So I'm wondering, as part as a byproduct of this move, once it is made official on Monday, February the 12th, if the Steelers will have to waive somebody to accommodate him on the 53-man roster. So I don't know anything other than to say, then stay tuned. It feels like that is what would have to happen here on February the 12th. Is you're claiming him off waivers. It's a deferred move. It feels like they would have to waive somebody to make room for him. And then at that point, come the rest of the offseason, you would just tender him as an exclusive rights free agent. Now, we're going way down the rabbit hole here of something we're not 100% sure of, but by looking at the Steelers roster, at least the way it ended, the 53-man roster, I would venture a guess that if indeed they had to waive somebody to make room for him, it would be one Kyron Johnson.
Any particular reason for that?
Just the lowest man on the totem pole, if you will. And because if you look at, you're not going to waive Darius Rush. You're not going to waive Rodney Williams. I wouldn't think you're going to waive Dylan Cook.
Could you, in theory, just waive one of the unrestricted free agents you don't intend on re-signing? Is there a downside to doing that?
The unrestricted guys, yeah, sure. You could probably go that route.
I don't know who that would be, though, to be honest, right, without looking at the list of names. And obviously, you could not waive one of those reserve future guys because they aren't even counting against your roster right now, technically, correct?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It has to be somebody that was, you know, under contract for the Ravens or for the Bills playoff game, for example.
Right, and I can't imagine the people lining up to claim Kyron Johnson off waivers. On top of it. So could you get in a situation where, all right, you waive Kyron Johnson, he clears waivers, you sign him to reserve future deal?
Sure, you could. I feel like there was an example of this happening before a couple years ago. I don't know exactly what it was. I'd have to research it, but this has had to have happened at some point. We can go back.
I'm sure it has. It probably has. I would have to go back and it would be a rabbit hole to go down to, and I'm not sure how I would attack it from a search standpoint and all. I don't think this is new, but are you trying to think of maybe a tight end or something?
Well,
because didn't the Patriots claim
it was a waived injured thing, right? That was something different, but I feel like this has happened late in the playoffs. I mean, just for us to understand what the next moves might be in terms of, will they have to make a roster move to accommodate that guy on the roster is kind of my question right now.
Yeah, and it feels like that's the way that has to go, though, right? Because if you're making a roster claim, and technically you're still in the 2023 league year and are going to be in the 2023 league year until March.
Right. But I'm just saying, can we find an example to see what the next steps are definitively to say, okay, this team had a similar scenario where they claimed somebody off of waivers in the playoffs. And once he got added after the Super Bowl, did they have to release somebody, or were they somehow able to add him onto the roster? I'm not entirely sure, but if we can just find that, then we can have a better understanding of the roadmap Pittsburgh will be following here.
Yeah, you're not asking too much, are you?
Let's see. I'm just kind of spitballing. In January 13, 2021, the Lions claimed linebacker Sean Dion Hamilton off waivers. I don't know where that came from. I don't know any information as I'm kind of searching through. That was from Washington. So maybe we can look up Sean Dion Hamilton, the Lions, and see what happened there, if that is a similar scenario.
All right. What's the name again?
Sean Dion, D-I-O-N, Hamilton from the Lions in January 2021. I don't believe Washington was in the playoffs at that point, but we're doing this live. We are definitely down the rabbit hole big time here on this Monday. So hopefully you guys are enjoying the ride.
Okay, so if they claimed, and that was the Lions that claimed Dion Hamilton, right? So if we go to the Detroit Lion, boy, this has got to be making for great podcasting.
People are loving this information today.
This is going
today,
to be a highly rated show. What was the date of that happening?
January 13th of 2021 was the day they announced though the Lions that they claimed him. So I wonder, because Pittsburgh has not actually announced that Jeremiah Moon has been claimed, because I guess the move is not officially processed.
All right. They do have on the Lions website, they have on 111 that the Lions acquire Sean Dion Hamilton via waivers. I'm not seeing.
This is really weird, because I was thinking, okay, did Washington make the playoffs that year? If they didn't, maybe the rules are different for teams who aren't in the playoffs as opposed to ones that were. Washington made the playoffs that year at 7-9. They were the wild card team. I think they won the division at 7-9. They lost on January 9th. So 4 days later, they had released, I guess, Dion Hamilton right around there. So their season was over by the time I think they had released him, I believe, and Baltimore season was not. So I don't know if these situations would be considered different in the NFL's eyes.
The thing that I'm looking for on the Lions website, was there somebody waive immediately after 111? And all I see is them signing three guys to reserve future contracts on the 13th there. So I would have to go to the NFL sheet.
But is this a different situation, because Washington was, I think, eliminated whenever they waived him and Baltimore was not?
The thing is you would think that teams would still have to carry a 53-man roster, you know, unless that gets lifted. I mean, we're once again, and that's why I started this thing I don't know the specifics related to this. I'm not going to pretend that I know the specifics related to this, but I promise to go down that rabbit hole today and see if I can pull a couple other names, and maybe something happened on the NFL sheet that was not listed on the, because we know teams aren't great sometimes of updating their own website, you know.
All right. So after that, I'm sorry, I pushed us down the road here. Probably shouldn't have. I was just trying to spitball, because there has to, my point is, I'm sure there's an example of this happening before. We can find out what the procedure is and adjust and anticipate from there. But point is, Jeremiah Moon will become a Steeler on February 12th, undrafted free agent.
All right, you got me that down this rabbit hole here.
There you go.
On January 20th, the Texans claim former Packers defensive lineman Kingsley Kiki off of waivers. The move is deferred until after the Super Bowl.
Okay.
Also, the Broncos on January 17th of 2022 claimed punter Corliss Waitman off waivers from the Steelers for the wire. That move will be deferred. So at least I'm not going to do this live, but at least we've got instances now that I can go down a rabbit hole and see if anybody had to be waived on the back end or something.
Yeah, there should be some examples there. So Corliss Waitman, thank you, Corliss, for your service, for punting for those few games, and also evidently maybe helping us solve this riddle that is this unique situation Pittsburgh's in with Jeremiah Moon.
Okay.
All right, so Jeremiah Moon will become a Steeler on February 12th, undrafted free agent in 2022 out of Florida. Spent, I believe, his rookie year on Baltimore's practice squad. Got some playing time this past year in 2023. Some on defense, some on special teams. Actually, quite a bit of snaps on special teams. Really interesting profile coming out, like 6'5", 250, 35-inch arms. Certainly looked the part. Jumped 40 and a half inches in his vert, 11-plus in his broad. Ran a respectable 4.76. You know, watching the tape, and the question to why he didn't get drafted was injuries. He was constantly injured at Florida, and so that was kind of the thing really holding him back. Watched him against the Colts, watched him against Pittsburgh in the finale. He played quite a bit of snaps. You know, he's got the profile, you know, more edge than off ball, played some more off ball at Florida. He's long. He's got to get a bit stronger, though, play with better pad level, work his hands better, refine his technique. But interesting guy that I think has the profile to be some depth and maybe be a special teamer in 2024.
Did they bring him in? Did the Steelers have, do we have anything on the site related to him pre-draft process?
I don't believe he was a pre-draft visitor. I don't know if they were at that Florida Pro Day. I assume somebody was, but I assume there were probably some other Gator prospects to check out.
All right. And, you know, we've talked, you know, recently about, you know, obviously they're going to have their top three in TJ Watt, Alex Highsmith, Nick Herbig. But there is some question about, you know, we'll see what happens with Marcus Golden this offseason, if they want him back. But we don't, at least on the surface, don't think that this team's going to, if this team does draft an outside linebacker, it would be super late, you would think. So it gives them another potential option to compete for like one of those 51 to 53rd roster spots, maybe.
Yeah, as a pass rusher, his reps were limited in the Ravens tape that I watched. He was basically playing in more base rundown situations. He likes to use the cross chop. It was not an effective move for him. There's some tightness. He's not really a real kind of ease and fluid and natural bender. So, you know, he's kind of a, you know, big defensive end that can play the run a bit, but has to work on his technique. Just some interesting tools and traits that I think try to develop is probably the driving reason behind going after somebody like a Jeremiah Moon.
And the key thing here is he's cheap. He would be on a minimum deal if indeed they have to adhere to his exclusive rights free agent classification here.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, it's a lot of layers to this. A guy that can't officially be part of the roster for a bit, and there's technically a pending free agent who, as you said, can easily be retained. But yeah, a lot. Just a weird one here for Pittsburgh, but gave us something to talk about.
Evidently, there's been more of this that's happened than we know. Let's see, January 16th, 2023, Jets claim veteran defensive tackle Isaiah Mack off waivers from the Seahawks. However, this move will be deferred until Monday. So there's the Bengals claim Chris Lammons off waivers from the Chiefs, deferred until February 13th. So there's a few instances to go search and see about the back end of this to see if teams had to. The key question here is do the Steelers have to open up a roster spot for this client?
Exactly. Yeah, that's the thing I'm most interested in. I just pulled up after the Corliss Waitman, when the Broncos claimed him, they actually were awarded two players via waivers on February 14th post Super Bowl. And I'm not seeing any mention of a player being released. I know, as you said, that they may not have just noted that on the team site. I'm looking at the Broncos website, which does not always capture everything, but I'm not seeing any notification of any player being waived. And so maybe they don't have to make a move.
Okay. That's quite interesting, especially when, and then I guess the other thing on top of that is there would be no remaining technical weeks left in the season of salary to have to claim under the cap.
Yeah. He's been paid out. They get paid now in 36 weeks. I don't get paid on a in season only basis, but I don't know if that's all just to Baltimore just owes all that money or not.
All right. We are way too deep in the weeds here without
there's
answers.
Like three people listening right now, and two of them probably hate listening at this point. So, all right. Jeremiah, do you have any thoughts on Jeremiah Moon? You watch Jeremiah Moon at all from a player standpoint?
Just a little bit. I mean, I understand why they did it. And once again, I think it's kind of a shrewd move overall, at least on the surface.
Yeah, I mean, there's really not much of a risk to it once your offseason roster opens up. And again, I think he's a toolsy guy that struggled with health in college and he's underdeveloped. I think he's pretty unrefined, but there's some traits to work with, some size that's appealing for Pittsburgh's system.
And if you can, you know, at least see if he's got some special teams aspect to him, you know.
Yeah, I mean, he played quite a bit in Baltimore. He actually was he was actually credited for 2 forced fumbles this year, both against Pittsburgh, although I don't think he really deserved either. He was in the area and kind of was on the tackle on Gunnar Olszewski on that terrible punt return fumble in week 5. And then also was credited for the one of Jalen Warren's fumbles that I believe Pittsburgh recovered in the finale, although he was kind of not even looking at Warren, and kind of Warren bumped into him and lost the football. So interesting note there. Had some success against Pittsburgh, though, and that, again, can be a reason why the Steelers were interested.
All right, get us out of this hole.
Yeah, I'm going to try my best here. I don't have a great place to go to. Some ex-Steelers playing in the Super Bowl. Pittsburgh not in the Super Bowl, but 5 former Steelers are headed that way, although not all of them will probably play in the big game. For San Francisco, it's Ray McCloud and Javon Hargrave. So congrats to both guys there. I maybe selfishly was rooting for the Lions because I wanted to see Tyson Alualu go to the Super Bowl, but Hargrave obviously deserving and good for him as well.
All right, and on the other side?
Let's see. For the Chiefs, it's going to be a couple of practice squad guys Chris Oladokun. I could have 2 Super Bowl rings in 2 years. You know, it all kind of worked out being kind of just unused by Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And then also Isaiah Bugs, former Lion, now former Steeler, former Lion, and now a former Chief. Also for the 49ers, our old friend Jesse Davis, the guard who did not play on the practice squad for the 49ers. He has a chance to win a ring.
All right.
I wanted to talk about one draft prospect that I had a profile on over the weekend. That is Clemson cornerback Nate Wiggins. And I got to do a bunch more research. I'm way behind. I'm not at the Senior Bowl this week because I'm kind of holding the fort down here. And so I'll be even kind of more behind in my draft stuff. But Wiggins, I thought his tape was really impressive. High-end cover corner, really good athlete. Good production, matured over his Clemson career. And this is a guy that I think we're going to hear at least talked about in contention for that 20th overall pick by Pittsburgh.
All right. I have not watched a lick of him. Tell me about him.
Yeah, really that. I mean, he's long. He's 6'2", little light.
He got some speed. He's got some speed to him, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. And he shows that speed both in just regular coverage, but 2 unbelievable effort plays, 2 forced fumbles he had in 2023, both chase downs, saving touchdowns at the goal line. Think Vance McDonald against the Bears chasing down that blocked field goal to prevent a touchdown. Similar type plays there, both in the scouting report I have on Steelers Depot. But really, man-to-man corner, compress, loose, fluid, good in his transition, his pedal, more man than zone in terms of what Clemson was running down there. They produced some pretty high end defensive back play. Concerns are, lankier, leaner, probably has to add some weight, add some strength. Tackling has to be more consistent. His run fits are poor, cracker play rules he can struggle on, and just kind of being, sound in your technique and your positioning. So those are the things to probably work on. Maybe a little too aggressive and kind of sits in his pedal too long as well. And his length to open his hips on some vertical routes. But overall, the tape was really impressive. That dude's got some ball skills, former wide receiver in high school. He's good post-catch. And so a guy that, again, I think will, assuming Pittsburgh does not make a big swing at corner in free agency for a Jarius Sneed or somebody like that, I think Wiggins is a name we'll be talking about quite a bit in this process.
All right. I can tell you a little something on a guy at the East-West Shrine game that caught my eye on the initial measurement sheet. And then I dove down to watch a couple of games of his, one from 2022, one from 2023. I'm talking about Logan Lee, the defensive lineman out of Iowa. The initial measurements that we had on him, I think, was 6'5" and 1/8", and like potentially, what did the sheet say? 300 and... where was it here? I'll have to find out what draft scout had on him ahead of him showing up. 6'05", 291 as far as initial measurements on him. Now, we got the official weigh-in measurements from the Shrine Bowl from Dr. Mel this morning. He measured in at 6'5", 1. Oh, wait a minute. Where'd he go here?
I'm seeing 6050.
Yeah, 6050, 286 pounds. Was real curious to see the arm length and the hand size on this. 32 3/8 on the arm and 9 7/8 inch on the hand. The hand size, not, I was hoping that'd be 10. I was hoping his weight would come in more than 286. I was hoping the arms would come in more than 32 3/8. But looking at that now and then rolling back through the tape, the thing that struck me on his 2022 tape was, A, he was used more, a lot more in a rotational role. I thought wasn't on the field as much. Now, I think they've got a history. They're kind of trying to rotate those guys.
Yeah. Van Ness was the issue last year, right?
Right. On rotating those guys through the offensive line there. So I'm not overly concerned on that. He was on the ground, at least on the one game that I watched, a little more to my liking in 2022. That got better in 2023. He had his and another thing that stuck out is it seemed like they primarily used him as a right of center, defensive tackle kind of. Now he did move kind of out a little bit on into, like, you know, 3-4 eye and stuff like that, but seemed to be primarily glued to the right side there. He had his moments, I guess, overall, that would stick out there. Once again, I thought he got better of keeping his feet underneath him. My main takeaway overall, not a refined pass rusher in any stretch of the imagination, doesn't have anywhere close to the hips, you know, that you would kind of hope to see out of an interior defensive lineman. Certainly nowhere close to what we've seen out of a Keanu Benton. Doesn't have the pass rush moves. And even though he was able to keep his feet, what I thought better in the 2023 tape, he felt like he needed more sand in his pants. And that's why I was kind of hoping he'd show up at the Shrine game at, like, you know, 298, 296 or something like that. Feels like his tape, he needs more underneath him there. And obviously it's a little bit disheartening to see a guy at 6'5" have 32 3/8 inch arms. What was, who was the guy we were talking about last year? Brian,
Brzee.
Yeah. What was
kind of similar, I think. I'll check his measurables, but it was in that vein in terms of what his measurables were, length and weight and those types of things. And obviously he did not become a Steeler. He came in at 6054, 302 with 32 1/2 inch arms. So the height and weight were good. The length was a little less than ideal.
Right. So, you know, that's and look, there's a reason he's at the Shrine game, you know, probably, and not the Senior Bowl and all like that. So even so, I would imagine, based on what I've seen and know about Logan Lee right now, he's going to be a guy that the Steelers, I think, are a good character guy and all like that. But he's more of going to be probably a 4th, 5th, 6th round kind of prospect.
Okay, so yeah, is there anybody? I was trying to look at the Shrine Bowl, just the measurements. Is there any other defensive lineman that would be interesting to look at that might fit that 4-eye, 3-tech mold the way that Pittsburgh likes it?
There's that Zion. How do you pronounce his last name? Logue. But evidently he hasn't really popped all that much, I don't think, according to Josh Carney, overall, and I think he's even sitting out today's practice with some sort of minor ailment and all, but he came in at 6'5" 1". Now I have not watched him at all. 6'5" 1/8, 308 pounds, 33 1/4 inch arms and 9 3/4 inch hands.
Yeah, one of those, probably. Guessing he was probably like a top recruit out of high school to be at Georgia with that kind of profile. There's that right behind him. I see on the listing here, Fabian Lovett from Florida State, 6'03", 3'03", 307, 34 5/8 inch arms. The height's not perfect, but it's acceptable, and the length I care about more. Production was not great at Florida State, 4 tackles for loss, a sack last year, but maybe one other guy to look into.
Yeah, as far as and that's as far as I've gotten, really.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, we've been busy trying to cover the fort. We'll start diving more into some of these players the deeper we get into this thing.
I think Josh talked up Miles Murphy from North Carolina. He came in 6'0", 3'7", 3'12", 33.5-inch arms, talked about his power, and kind of had some comparisons to Hayward in terms of just stylistically, in terms of how they play, what their approach is to football. So I think he's got a little bit of buzz down in Frisco this week.
A couple of wide receivers, I think, to keep an eye on. Josh Cephas out of University of San Antonio. Mm-hmm. He is a guy that actually, I don't know how I came across up late one night, probably watching one of those games on Sportsnet or whatnot like that. Really caught my eye, and I even tweeted about him, wondering what he would run. 6'2", 2'8", 189 pounds, 31-inch arms. He apparently has the Steelers' attention. What's the report we have on him on the site?
He's had multiple meetings with Pittsburgh at the Hula Bowl and then also at the Shrine Bowl. Again, meetings, they talked to a bunch of guys, mm-hmm. but a couple of repeat conversations with some resumes, some production Cephas has had. Something to note.
Malik Washington is evidently having really showing out at the Shrine Bowl. Undersized guy, 5'8", 192 pounds. I pulled up it looks like he predominantly worked in the slot at Virginia there. And all I've watched on him is just one of those Virginia highlight films and all like that. But I mean, for his size, and slot experience, made a lot of plays at Virginia there. But once again, you know, 5'8" and 1/8, really undersized there. I think he did some return action for them as well too.
Yeah, there was Dontavian Wicks. Well, recently, different body type. He was a longer kind of guy, but versatile and having success in Green Bay. So, you know, again, all names to watch here. I think one of the top names is, and this will be a little interesting guy to potentially scout here, Quantez Stiggers, a corner and college, not available. He's from the CFL, Toronto Argonauts. He actually did not really attend college, and I don't know his entire backstory there, but Stiggers apparently has been earning buzz and could be that rare player that really didn't play in college that gets drafted. It has happened before, but it is pretty rare.
What is he? What, 5'11", 3'8", right? 203.
Yeah. So
I don't know anything about him other than that. I have not pulled up any CFL tape or anything on him.
Sounds like a good week though in the East-West Shrine Bowl. So interesting story there. And he certainly got a lot of attention because of that, but the play might be backing that up. But yeah, the guys have done a great job, and gals, Dr. Melanie Friedlander down there as well, with Joe Clark, Tony Calderon, and Josh Carney at the Shrine Bowl. And we'll have Ross McCorkle. He's driving to Mobile right now for the Senior Bowl alongside Jonathan Heitrider to give you guys coverage from both places throughout the rest of the week.
All right. And we hope to, after things get settled and these people get back from the All-Star games, have them on for a roundtable session to learn more about these prospects.
That is a must. We'll definitely have all those people on to get their impressions, but ton of interviews. I know Melanie had mentioned that Pittsburgh talked with Florida State quarterback Jordan Travis, who of course suffered that terrible leg injury late in last year. He's not working still, obviously, at the Shrine Bowl, hopes to do something at his pro day. Probably won't do anything at the combine either, other than just interviews, medical and all that kind of stuff. So got some attention on the site yesterday, given the quarterback, given his name, again, talking to a wide group of people at these All-Star games, talking to essentially everybody, but something to file away as well.
I tell you, there's a couple of 35-inch arm tackles that'll be fun to look at some tape and get some feedback on. Hosea Ezram out of Eastern Kentucky. Walter Roos out of Oklahoma, 6'5", 4'8", 319, 35 3/8-inch arms. That Aneem Dankwa out of Howard, small school kid, 6'7", 2'8", 362, 35 3. What was the measurement on the tackles and arms?
On the tackles and arms?
Yeah, that the Steelers that we had tattooed that the Steelers like.
Pat Meyer prefers length or his whole first significant contact mantra. I mean, 33 is the benchmark for tackle generally across the board. In Pittsburgh, it's probably, it's been longer recently, you know, 35, 34 and a half inch plus when you look at some of the guys that they've looked at Broderick Jones, even go back to LaRaven Clark, just in terms of the size profile.
All right, here's what I have from a tweet from March 24th of this of 2023. Arm length of last five tackles. This obviously did not include Broderick Jones, who was over the threshold, but not one of them under 34 inches. Dan Moore was 34 and a half. Derwin Gray was 34 and 3/8. Tecumseh Okorafor, 34 and a half. Gerald Hawkins, 34. And a quarter, and Mike Adams, 34. And what was Broderick's arms?
I think over that, as you said, I don't know exactly what it was off the top of my head, but he should have met that threshold. And again, even some of the free agents they brought in, some of the other guys they've looked at all kind of meet that mark. 34 and three quarters was the arm length on Broderick Jones.
Okay. All right. So there's a handful of tackles here in the East-West Shrine with 34 or greater arms.
And Pittsburgh could certainly be in those tackle waters. They should be probably come draft time.
All right.
All right, Dave, what's your reaction to the playoffs? Again, the Chiefs holding off the Ravens 17-10. Baltimore's about 17-10. They lost to Pittsburgh by both those scores, at least the Chiefs by that score. What's your reaction to the Ravens season coming to an end?
First and foremost, why didn't they run the football more other than Lamar Jackson? Lamar Jackson had eight carries in that game. But when you combine their two running backs that they used in the game, Gus Edwards and Hill, six rushes for those two guys combined. Now, Zay Flowers had a couple of runs in that game, and Lamar Jackson, of course, had eight. But in a close ball game like that, as it was, it makes you kind of wonder why they were so damn pass heavy, you know?
It's a great point. And I think Edwards ran well early and they really didn't give him the ball much the rest of the way. So, and I'm sure some of those eight runs were probably scrambles. So Lamar Jackson too. I don't know how many of those were actually designed. I know a couple were. There was a quarterback power on a short yarded situation that he converted. I mean, it's probably an obvious statement. I just look at the way some of these teams have lost games, and not to discredit the Chiefs at all, who did a great job to beat such a tough Ravens team that have taken it to so many talented teams this year, the 49ers, the Lions, et cetera. But just so many missed chances, these losing teams, you know, so many self-inflicted wounds, Zay Flowers with a taunting call, with a fumble diving over the goal line.
What a key moment in that game. Whew.
Yeah, just stuff like that where there's so many missed opportunities where if you just do, I think about Mike Tomlin's phrase, routine things routinely, and just make the plays that are right there that aren't special and would get not even talked about otherwise, just taking care of the football at the goal line, you know, they may win that game. And I think about the Packers dropping interceptions and missing field goals. I think about the Lions squandering their opportunities, dropping passes. And so, again, obviously, you know, the victor should get the credit, but I just think about missed opportunities these teams on the losing end make. When you're in the playoffs, you've gotten this far. It's always talented teams. These games are always tight. And so you don't have that margin for error. Whoever makes that kind of just critical mistake often loses the game. And that's what happened, I think, in both these contests.
I tell you, look at the box score alone. The Ravens, and you look at the key elements in there. First and foremost, you can't get past the three turnovers for the Ravens and zero for the Chiefs. Second, the penalties. Baltimore had some stupid penalties in this game. Eight in total for 95 yards. The Chiefs had three for just 30 yards. And the other important element here, third downs. The Chiefs were 8 of 18, and the Ravens were 3 of 11. That's a recipe in those three stats alone of third down, turnover. I mean, how many you lose a turnover battle 3-0 in a playoff game? How many times are you going to win a ball game there? And then the penalties. There was, you know, Travis Kelce goaded him into one of those penalties. Flowers obviously had the one at the taunting after the catch. There was one. What was the who had the hit up high on Mahomes?
Clowney roughing the passer. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and not only three turnovers, but one on the goal line and one in the end zone when Baltimore was, you know, around the 20-yard line, whatever it was. And so even if you get a field goal in any of those instances, it's still a one-possession game. So, yeah, I mean, just crucial, crucial missed opportunities and crucial giveaways.
And I think Spagnuolo, as I mentioned during the podcast the other day, and why I picked the Chiefs to cover, just thought Spags might have a little something for them defensively, and he did. I mean, heck, to hold that hold that Ravens offense to just one touchdown, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, the Ravens holding the Chiefs to 17. I know the Chiefs' offense has not been as electric, but the Chiefs came out hot. They had a good script. And once they got off script, I mean, Baltimore really locked things down. It was there for the taking for Baltimore. I think
sure
they just
was.
Did not take advantage of their opportunities.
Kelce had a monster day, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he was vintage Kelce. And sometimes those playoff teams, man, they just really come alive. Teams like the Chiefs that have been there before, the moment's not new to them. They know how to rise up in the biggest games. And it kind of feels like the Chiefs are always that team. I mean, you know, Mahomes has made it to the AFC title game every year he started. I mean, just crazy stuff like that. So these moments don't get to them, even though they were on the road. And, you know, for the first time, basically, this playoff run, it didn't bother them.
All right, what about that other game? There's going to be more talk about that one, I think, than the Ravens-Chiefs one.
Yeah, the elephant in the room, Dan Campbell's aggression, going for it twice on fourth down, one on fourth and two, instead of kicking a short field goal, one on fourth and three with about, I think, 5 minutes to go, and passing up a 47-yard attempt, and both unsuccessful. I was fine with going for it on fourth down on the first conversion there. I was okay with that. It made sense to me. The second one, I know analytics say this, and people can disagree. I would have kicked the field goal, though. I think you have to kick the field goal in that situation.
Well, let's start with this. Dan Campbell's stuck to who he's been, you know. Mm-hmm. And after the game, he listened a little bit to his press conference. He did not apologize for going in those instances there. I'm with you on your analysis on both of them. I mean, if Josh Reynolds catches that, I mean, it's not even a discussion. Again, you get into some of these discussions about the analytics and fourth down and all like that. And, the discussions come out of, was it successful or not?
For sure. I mean, these are always results oriented, and that's how every weighty, aggressive decision gets viewed. I understand that.
You know, so, I mean, if they convert that, that's not even, I mean, that play gets lost, you know?
Or just praised for way right. to go, Dan Campbell. Great aggression. They punch it into the end zone. It's viewed as Dan Campbell aggressively leading Detroit to victory.
Now, because they didn't get it, and because of what immediately happened in the next several minutes after that, it becomes a single play that gets circled in red on the play sheet as a turning point in the game.
Which it was, to be fair, but again, I view it. I'm not somebody that's trying to use hindsight. I still think it was the right decision to go for it the first time, even though it did not work. I know you could have made it, I think, three scores had you kicked the field goal, but I think in that situation, you want to put up as many points on the board as possible. You probably anticipate the 49ers, they're not going to go away quietly. They're not going to just lay down a comeback as possible, which is obviously exactly what happened. So you're trying to build as much of a lead as possible. So I'm good with that, even though it did not work out. On the other end, 5 minutes to go, I know their kicker is shaky, which, first of all, if you want to say their kicker is shaky, the coach in the front office is responsible for who your kicker is. If you don't trust your kicker to make a 47-yard field goal, that's on you for probably poor roster construction, not having a kicker that you should, you know, should have probably switched out kickers at some point in the year. So there's a blame inherently for construction, even though it might be the right decision based on how badly it kicked during the year. But I think that situation, you're down three. It's still a makeable kick. It's not 50 plus yards. If you don't make that, if you don't convert there, you may not get the ball back. And Detroit did, but they were down two scores at that point. So, you know, hindsight's 20-20. And I understand, you know, the way these things are judged, it's based off the outcome. But I was saying kick the field goal before they went for it. I will still say they should have tried for three.
And points stop the bleeding, at least at that point, because you're bleeding profusely at that point, right?
Well, just tie the game. I mean, tie the game. I mean, it's 5 minutes left, and you're going against a run-heavy San Francisco team. And you
build a positive, something positive back in there on top of it. It definitely after failing to get that one, there probably weren't many people to think that we're going to win that game at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I get the adage, live by the sword, die by the sword, but that was juggling the sword. You know, it just seemed to be overly reckless. And I know if it converts, then he's a genius. And I understand how the business works. I'm not trying to crush the guy. I just think there have been times where he's been just a little over aggressive. You think about the Cowboys game going for two when they're at the seven based off all those penalties, just kick the extra point, you know, just be sensible there. There are limits. And, You know, I know the analytics crowd. I'm not anti-analytics, obviously. I'm saying you should have gone for it on the first failed fourth and two, but you can't these conversations can't be in just a vacuum, just a pure number alone. And if you can't have a conversation about it either way, then you're probably too close-minded to begin with.
They did almost everything. They had everything go their way in the first half of that game too. And then, you know, the Gibbs fumble, you know, not long after that, what failed fourth down. I mean, the whole game, the whole tide of the game just turned so damn quick, and they could not, you know, 49ers stayed to who they were and kept chipping away at it. And the Lions obviously helped them. McCaffrey ran the ball well. Purdy made some good, you know, not really known for making plays with his legs, I guess, overall, made some key scrambles with his legs. Your boy Jennings had a hell of a catch, only one catch in the game, and it was came on the end of a very ill-advised decision by Purdy, but Jennings made the play. They finally, you know, they didn't. Kittle in that first half didn't even have, he had, what, one target, zero catches. They actually got him the ball a couple of times in the second half. There and Ayuk had a catch Ayuk had in that one to help throttle that comeback. And then Debo Samuel.
Yeah. And McCaffrey, they couldn't tackle him, and it was a really good team effort. Again, I've talked about Juwan Jennings a lot. I know he's restricted free agent. I understand he's not really no way to feasibly get him this year, but I can dream a little bit, maybe 2 years from now, talk about that. But that's the type of receiver I would love to see in Pittsburgh, the big slot that can block, make those tough catches. I think it's a really good fit for what the Steelers want and need and are looking for. But yeah, to the point, Lions squandering their chances, the 49ers taking advantage. They didn't quit. You know, they're fighting, and congrats to them for it.
Well, that whole game will get boiled down to the fourth down decisions, yep. Period.
Yep, it will. So, I mean, it'll be talked about, but Super Bowl will be played, and that'll be forgotten, I guess, at some point, at least outside of Detroit circles. But yeah, so I mean, you just feel they were so close. The Lions were, I mean, up 24-7, they're right there, and to lose it like that is just painful.
Yeah, absolutely. It had to be heartbreaking for them in that locker room afterwards. All right,
Dave, any other topics to talk about? Anything else from a draft perspective, coaching perspective, anything we missed today?
Not that I can think of right off the top of my head, and we're short staffed, so I imagine we should fire through this a little real quick here. Want to get to some emails and close this thing out?
Yeah, let's get to some emails and close out today's show.
Bryce on the OC, whether it's Bieniemy, Arthur Smith, or someone else, the biggest question to me is, will Tomlin revamp this passing game with a more dedicated pass game coordinator? The Ravens showed last night that you have to be able to find an efficient passing game that gives you more answers to beat good defenses. Here's the thing about the Ravens, man. It felt like they should have been running more.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, Lamar threw it 37 times. He dropped back over 40 times in that one. And that was really out of their character, considering, like you said, how close this game was.
Because he says the Ratbirds showed last night, you have to be able to find an efficient passing game that gives you more answers to beat good defenses. I don't know where that statement's coming from, because my initial takeaway is, man, why weren't they running more there? But he wants to know, the biggest question is, will Tomlin revamp the passing game more with regardless with a dedicated pass game coordinator?
I don't know. They haven't done it before, and their coaching staffs are pretty small compared to the rest of the league. I mean, I think I've always referred to Pittsburgh's OC as the de facto pass game coordinator, because my understanding is the O-line coach really kind of handles the run game install and game planning. And so what would a dedicated pass game coordinator do on top of your OC? I'm not sure what that labor looks like, but, you know, however you can, you know, add smart people that can benefit you, I'm all for it.
Second part of this is, do you think Tomlin needs to let go of his not having too many cooks in the kitchen philosophy when it comes to his staff? It hasn't produced the desired results, so I would say bring in more senior analyst type coaches that can add more nuance and perspective to some of the more outdated schemes. So he basically wants to know, should Mike Tomlin embrace a larger staff?
Yeah, again, I mean, potentially it's hard to know without knowing the inner workings of, you know, how their operation is and how smooth and fluid, and if it needs more people. There's benefits and, you know, pros and cons to it. I do the study each year on the largest and smallest coaching staffs, and I've not really found a perfectly clear correlation between the larger the coaching staff, the more successful you are. I think maybe it skews that way a little bit. I think some of these more younger coaches are embracing a larger coaching staff, and maybe some of the older coaches. Typically, Tomlin and Belichick and the Patriots have the smallest coaching staffs in football. But it's less about how many people, but who are the people and the quality of the people and what their roles are. And are we all on the same page and kind of rowing the same boat, as opposed to just throw as many people as possible into a coaching staff in a room and figure things out?
Rob Enos writes in, David Ox, if the Chargers cut Keenan Allen, do you think the Steelers would be interested? Do you think he's a good fit? And what do you think it would cost to sign him? Oh boy. Haven't even looked at his situation. I mean, here's the thing I know about Keenan Allen. I've had him in a couple of high dollar fantasy leagues as of late. The guy can't stay healthy when I need him. He is also going to be 32 years of age. He's coming off of a pretty nice season, right? 108 catches, 1,200 yards, 7 touchdowns. Keenan Allen obviously historically has been a good player. You do kind of wonder about what his cost will be coming off of a 1,200 yard season. He is under contract though, right?
You know, I think he said, but if they cut Keenan Allen, then that'd be the mechanism. I don't know his exact status, but that sounds right. Yeah, I mean, I've always been a fan of Keenan Allen. Again, we're talking kind of slot underneath type role. I could see it. You know, it would really depend on the dollar amount and the structure of the contract for a guy that's about to be 32 with health concerns.
Right, and the age, you know, the Steelers, you know, although they've made some strides in that area when it comes to signing a little bit older guys, especially when it comes to defensive side of football, you know, they've made some exceptions there. My gut tells me they won't be players in with him if he's cut, but, you know, stay tuned. Let's see. Lenny writes in, Alex, I totally agree with your article on Sunday that we have an evaluation talent problem, but what about this organization's inability to draft a solid cornerback? I think three of the bigger sins would have been Edmonds, Burns, and Bush. Hopefully Omar doesn't make these same mistakes or it will push this team back even further. Question, looking back, would you guys hire Mike Tomlin again? I'm a fan, but I don't think he's that great of a coach. 17 years in one Super Bowl. If we had to do it all over again, I would not hire him. Looking at his body of work as a coach, what say Yins? First and foremost, I mean, it's hard to – I mean, you know, the whole hindsight and what has happened. Short answer, I would hire Mike Tomlin again back in 2007.
I would too. Probably get some hate mail for that one. Right. And I can listen, I've talked about the lack of success in recent years, and I loathe he never had a losing season stat. But given the body of work overall and the unknown, we always think about the grass is greener and this next guy might be the guy. I don't think if they had hired Russ Grimm or whoever would have had 17 years in the resume that Mike Tomlin has. So I would do it all over. No regrets on the actual hire. I mean, well, he said cornerbacks and he mentioned a safety and a linebacker.
Right. He mentions a safety, cornerback in Burns, and then Devin Bush after saying the organization's inability to draft a solid cornerback. Lenny, what do you think about Joey Porter Jr.?
Pretty good. What I would say about that, I mean, that's a longer timeline, but I would say I think Pittsburgh overcorrected after missing on Jarvis Jones and pushed too strongly towards let's get a really good athlete in the door, because Jones was not athletic and they wanted to athleticism is important, obviously, and you have to have that. Maybe they overcorrected and were taking some guys that were just uber athletic. They didn't have the nuance, the technique, the fundamentals to be solid football players. So that'd be a critique. You have to critique it though, not from a individual player, but what is the commonality? What is the common theme? Not just they missed on this guy, they missed on that guy, but are there common threads to tie the picks together? When I mentioned Leal and Green and Dotson. It's playing guys out of position, not knowing where to play them, moving these guys around, not having a good feel for their strengths and maximizing their ability, getting the most out of them. So that's why I kind of had that string of evaluating the trenches and where guys fit, and they're trying to move these guys out of their natural positions, and that's creating harm. We're seeing this potentially with Broderick Jones. So you can criticize the philosophy, but there has to be a commonality, not just they missed on this guy and that guy and that guy. You have to be more specific than that.
Well, they have gone uber RAS though, have they not? But within that, what I couldn't help when watching that Lions game. Remember when John Kaminsky got cut, and I said
you were talking about him.
Oh man! I mean, you pull up the RAS on him, and you know, at the time, the Steelers could obviously have used a developmental defensive lineman on the practice squad, because that's probably where, you know, maybe he would have ended up at the time. And look what he's become for the Lions now at that point. So you think they go all in. Now, of course, you know, we don't know the hearts and smarts, but John, you know, at least on the surface, Kaminsky looked like a pretty clean prospect overall. You look at how all in they have been on the metrics and all like that, and then you let somebody free for the taking just fall right past you there. Yeah, and that's an isolated incident. It's easy to do. Mm-hmm. It's easy to point to, because at the time it was easy for me to point to it. So I'm not broad brushing it by any stretch. It's just something that comes to mind there. But I mean, this team has, look, I mean, Alex, every year, one of the highlights of the offseason is what the Steelers look for. And we just even talked about it earlier in this show, talking about tackles and arm length. How many good tackles maybe has this team bypassed because they couldn't feed themselves?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they've had success with shorter, stubbier tackles than the Kelvin Beachum, you know, for example, but
Look at some of these corners now. You can, I mean, these corners now, you can look at their arm length, look at their weight, look at their height, and say, you can say right away, the Steelers don't like that guy. But then on the flip side, they turn around, and a guy like Calvin Austin, the third, really, when you look at past drafts in this team and wide receivers, he was outside the norm of what they go after.
Yeah, there's variables and exceptions, and you know, then you're getting into outside receiver versus slot receiver and the different body types and skill sets that exist there. If they go draft a slot corner, he probably won't be 6'2 with 34-inch arms. He's probably going to be, you know, 5'10 and 32-inch arms, because he's a slot guy and there's a different skill set to be had there. But yeah, I mean, a corner, I mean, they are as typecast as any team right now. It's very Chris Ballard, like they want those long physical press corners. So they've certainly leaned into the athleticism more post Jarvis Jones, but they've also, I think, focused a little less on just, okay, who's a good athlete? We'll coach him up. There's kind of been a middle ground they found between guys that are a bit more refined, but are also obviously pretty athletic.
Then you got a guy like Isaiah Loudermilk, who they fell all over themselves at because of the body type, that the tape wasn't necessarily there, you know?
Sure. There's a lot of layers and, you know, scarcity at a position. And when you get in the fifth round, and they traded up for Loudermilk, so that they really had to have liked the guy to move up. They did do that, right? They moved up for Loudermilk, correct? Mm-hmm. Which is kind of a funny thought there.
And he told us why, because of the body type, you know?
Right. Yeah. The scarcity, although he's not long, he's just tall. I mean, I don't know. Kind of a weird one overall. Guess it hasn't really worked out great, but it could have been worse overall. DeMarvin Leal's been a worse return on investment. So yeah, there's a whole conversation we can have about, you know, philosophies and benchmarks and exceptions and all that kind of stuff that we'll talk about, I'm sure, throughout the offseason.
Here's the thing. Start marrying more tape in with it.
Yeah, it's always a balance, though, because athleticism and testing is important. I mean, you can draw some pretty clear lines between, you know, if a guy has offensive linemen and short shuttle times, if they're under, 4.4 or 4.5, then you have a really high, you know, chance of success. And, you know, a guy doesn't run well at a different position, he might not have that chance of success. So it's why it's an art, not a science. If this was a science, then we'd all be perfect drafters and everyone would be fantastic and no one would ever miss on a pick, but it's the draft and it's unpredictable.
All right, one more for Todd Gentzler here. For a fun and easy exercise, considering the Steelers' first-round draft pick, who is in consideration for selection at 20 for the following positions? Oh, Lord, this is going to be way too early for us, Todd. He says, who is in consideration at offensive line, defensive line, defensive back, and linebacker. He says, I have to believe it's going to be one of these positions. And for kicks, who would be available as a quarterback at number 20? What would you do? Todd, we're still scratching the surface trying to learn, the names, let alone positions on some of these guys, because we are so Steelers centric during the season that it's not until a week after the Senior Bowl where I really start feeling, oh, okay, I'm getting a little bit better grasp on this class. So there's absolutely no way I could sit here and throw names at you at number 20 for offensive line, defensive back, and linebacker.
No shot either. And usually,
we're trying to be upfront, and we don't just try to throw names just to throw names, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and usually I benefit by going to the Senior Bowl and having some exposure to those guys, and I won't get that this year, but it will give me some more time to watch some tape. With the quarterbacks, who could be there? It's still early, but Bo Nix from Oregon, potentially Michael Penix from Washington. Some debate about where he's going to go. Is he a round one guy? Is he a round two type of guy? Not entirely sure, but those will be the two names that probably get talked about the most in terms of quarterback and drafting in Pittsburgh, because Jaden Daniels and Caleb Williams and Drake May all likely to be long gone before pick 20.
Todd, this is the type of year with Alex and I where it's a huge, huge learning process over these next really 2.5 weeks here, where we try to take all the info that we get in from the people that we have at the All-Star games. And when we're not short staffed, which is the case right now, we try to dive into as much tape as we can. I mean, we've actually talked probably more about individual players earlier this year. I mean, you've already got like three profiles up, and we talked about the Missouri defensive lineman. We talked about the Clemson guy. Who was the other?
Zach Frazier from West Virginia. Zach, we talked about a lot.
And then we talked about the Iowa kid today. So we're actually probably a little bit further ahead than we normally are. But we're it's going to be a week after the Senior Bowl before we're able to really and get some of these guys on the podcast and have some of these group conversations where we start getting a lot more comfortable talking about this year's draft class.
Yeah. One other quick draft note. The next guy I'm going to do a profile on is Ladd McConkey from Georgia. Really fun kind receiver, bursty, twitchy, good route runner, high effort type of dude, speed, yak opportunity. The volume wasn't huge in Georgia's offense, but some really fun tape.
Yeah, absolutely. And fortunately, because of SEC guy being shown, Georgia being shown a lot, I been able to watch a little bit of him just on TV throughout the year naturally.
Yeah, so one guy potentially on my radar, but again, we're very early and we'll lean on our team out there at the Senior Bowl, at the Shrine Bowl, get their advice, have them on the podcast, and they will, I'm sure, fill you guys up with information.
All right, we actually got a little bit of time out of this episode, didn't we? We spent so much time talking about the moon thing. We went over the moon.
Hey. Flew close to the sun, and now we're back and be back on Wednesday.
All right. So with that, until Wednesday, you can follow me on Twitter/X at Steelers Depot. Follow Alex on Twitter at Alex_Kozora. Follow the show at Terrible Podcast. Email the show, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. If you like what we do and want to donate to the cause, SteelersDepot.com. Hit the donate button. Also, if you'd like an ad-free version of the site, find that on the site. If you've experienced the site being down in the last, 48 hours, apologies on that. Our host is making some server adjustments that haven't gone perfect, and we pride ourselves on having uptime quite a bit. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened the last 48 hours. We apologize. Hopefully, they've got most of that under control when it comes to that. So until Wednesday, as always, thanks for listening to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Alex.